the group, who was sick with a fever and in bed, was dragged out of his house. They tied him up, then forced him down to the ground so that the people in the next houses would not see what was happening. Then they came to my nephew's house. When they were marched past me, my nephew gave me a look of, "Please speak to them," but I never imagined they were going to their death. Then they came to my home. My 13-year-old son told them where I was, and they sent for me. They pointed their guns at me, and I came to their leader with my hands up. He asked my name and looked at a long list of names. Mine was not on it, so I was dismissed. Then about 8 a.m., we heard shots from about a kilometer away. Some of the brothers went into town to the military headquarters and asked what was happening, but they were not answered. They were told the colonel was in a meeting and could not attend to them. About 1 hour later, the soldiers returned in their trucks, but our brothers were not with them. The soldiers said they had been in combat. We went to see our brothers. We knew it was an unjust death. All of them were tied up. Their bodies were scattered, some thrown in the river, some in the bushes. Many faces were unrecognizable. Some were without their heads. Forgive me for speaking this way about my brothers, but it is my responsibility to speak the truth. This massacre took the lives of 74 men in that cooperative. Everyone left children. While this man was speaking, a woman that was sitting to the side began to weep, and then the translator said that her husband had been one of the people killed in this mass murder, leaving 5 children. The captains of this military unit were named. There were too many witnesses to the nature of the killing for the Army to continue with its story of combat. Nevertheless, in spite of the evidence and the witnesses, there has been no prosecution. Furthermore, 3 days before we visited, the men were pinned down by another Army group for about a half an hour with guns pointed at their heads and told they were going to be executed. They were not. It was obviously harassment. But the harassment continues. Needless to say, our group left that site emotionally drained. The very next day, in San Salvador, we went to the site of a refugee camp from the October 1986 earthquake that you remember went right through San Salvador. And this was a vacant lot that had really been squatted on for all practical purposes. It was owned by a German family, had been vacant for quite a few decades. The mainline churches in the area, not the extreme fundamentalist, but the Lutheran, Episcopalian, decided that the way they would work with people was not to give individual aid, but they would require people to organize groups, and then they would divide up the groups and work with them. And we went to the site where the Lutherans had been working with this group. So we saw a group of shacks that were made out of corrugated steel. There were about 160 people in this lot, no electricity, some drainage ditches dug for water and sewage, little cardboard boxes in the back that you would go into for the purposes of restroom, one place of water. A lot of women and children. The women would make their living by selling in the streets. There's about 70% unemployment or underemployment in San Salvador. The children were not in school because the women would barely make enough to feed themselves and their family. They did not have the extra money to pay for the book fees. As a matter of fact, sometimes they had to take the small children, lock them in the little shack without windows for the day so that when they went out in the streets, they wouldn't have to worry if something was going to happen to the children. One woman showed us a picture of her 12-year-old daughter who she had taken out to sell in the streets, and she was run over by a truck. These people were right on the edge. We found out that one day before, they and 13 other groups such as they had gone to the presidential palace to present a request that they could in some way get a governmental loan to buy this property because there was a lot of pressure to get them off. Sometimes police, as a matter of fact, would try to evict the people So they would even place guards so that they would protest if the police tried to take apart the shacks at night. They were not even received. They were not even acknowledged. This, a group of people who haven't received a dime of the $1 million in aid, millions and millions of aid that had been given for earthquake refugees. What was astounding to me, as I saw this wonderful work done by the Lutheran Church with these very poor people, was that the Lutheran Church was coming under severe harassment for doing this work. In the spring, the offices of the Lutheran Church in El Salvador had been taken over by the police, all records confiscated at gunpoint. A child care facility had been bombed that August. The bishop, Medardo Gomez, had been threatened again with death. The death squads made sure his family knew, and his 9-year-old daughter just had a nervous breakdown. This kind of harassment was going on because they were working with the poor. The question that it began to raise for me was, why is this happening in a country that Elliot Abrahams is telling me is a model for budding democracy and the wave of the future in Central America? Why is this happening? Why no prosecutions? Why this kind of harassment? Human rights investigator that we also listened to began to describe that human rights are not getting better qualitatively, even though quantitatively they've been reduced, that the death squad system remains intact. We then moved to Nicaragua, where we also visited co-ops and saw that they were going better and the people were proud and they were not harassed. We also visited a refugee camp, and though the government had little to give them, they felt welcome. Salvadorian refugees fleeing to Nicaragua. We listened to the opposition, but I gained a very distinct impression again that here was a place that was trying to take reform seriously. This was the place that the United States was obsessively trying to destroy. So it began to raise some questions for me. How do I put this together in some kind of a meaningful whole so that as a parish pastor I speak not just from my gut but also from my head? How can I make sense out of this? For this reason, I came to this summer and the last few weeks with four questions in my mind. And I would not have the opportunity to go in any detail with any one of them, but I do want to conclude on them before we get to here because I think it's probably important. The first question is, what is and has been the U.S. policy in Central America? What drives it? Are there any consistent themes? Because the Latin American expert on our trip said, if there's one thing that characterizes U.S. foreign policy to Central America, it's consistency over the last 100 years. So I wanted to find out what are the consistent patterns that run through. The second thing was brought up from the interviews. A concept called low-intensity warfare was introduced. I read a magazine article on it. It was very provocative. I want to describe what that is. I found some good articles and a good book, 1988, that's detailing low-intensity conflict because this, it seems to me, gives an interpretive key to understanding a lot of what's currently going on in Central America. I wanted, thirdly, to look a little bit at liberation theology, and then, fourth, to ask the question about the local parish. So, could I just give some conclusions that I arrived at, not as an expert, but I suppose the very fact that I've taken the time to read would mean that I'd probably be better informed than maybe 99% of the American public, because we don't generally tend to read about small countries in the United States. I also found that out. Give some conclusions with U.S. policy very quickly. Spend a little more time describing low-intensity warfare because I don't think most people are aware of its philosophy and what it's trying to get at and how it affects us. Very briefly to mention some conclusions about liberation theology because that's being done in the lectures this week. And then to talk about the local parish. What would be the conclusion about U.S. foreign policy? Status quo is a big word. It seems from my reading that the U.S. wants very much to keep the status quo, which is to maintain its very dominant sphere of influence politically and economically in this region that is so very close to it, where it incidentally has some very advantageous arrangements for trade in those areas. Walter Altman, who was is a Brazilian Lutheran liberation theologian who just left last Saturday, drew a very helpful little diagram, which I thought explains why U.S. foreign policy would value the status quo. This is why he drew it, but I thought it was important. He drew two circles, one representing North American continent, the other representing South American continent. Talked about the haves and the have-nots. Now, let's suppose that two-thirds of the North American continent might be called haves. We certainly have our group that would pull the strings, but in Latin America, and let's say Central America, a very tiny percentage have. The rest have not. And I can't stress that strongly enough. For those of you who have had contact, it's unbelievable. One person might have five homes, travel to the French Riviera for vacation. On their farm are people, some of whom are starving to death. That would characterize El Salvador. That's the kind of a disparity. Where are the ties with business? They run from here to here. And is so typical of even our country, these people become kind of invisible. As a matter of fact, when I was driving to west and went by a turkey farm in Wilmer, if any of you have seen these giant turkey farms, you get thousands and thousands of turkeys that exist for kind of a conveyor belt existence where eventually they're going to get killed to put food on our tables. The image suddenly struck me that in a sense, the mentality is that these are the turkeys. They exist for us, and they do not exist in any other right than that. And so there's a very strong tie between the oligarchy, as it's termed, and our interests. And the general philosophy has been that you support this. What happens if somebody in here wants to reform? Who squawks? Obviously these people. Perhaps I would in the same situation. What do they yell? Communists. And you know that that presses our button about as well as anything. But I think the important thing is to know is that historically this has been going on for long before there were communists. That there has been a very strong influence there. Increasingly, in the U.S. policy, we have used an investment in the oligarchy's military, which means that we not only have the oligarchy here as a vested interest, but we have an increasingly strong professional military with a very direct tie to the United States, because that's where most of our aid money has been going for stability and security. And what the U.S. is very concerned about doing is using its political, economic, and military might in order to keep this sphere of influence in line so that its economic advantages continue and you do not have outside influence. Hence, you'll have direct military invasions, covert invasions, influencing, etc. What struck me as I was reading this policy is that one of the key words that we in the church are becoming increasingly aware of, namely world poverty, does not figure into U.S. foreign policy. It is acknowledged all the way through. But then once it's acknowledged, there seems to be an underlying assumption that somehow if the capitalist system is allowed to work, it's going to take care of itself. At any rate, we don't want the communists fomenting anything. And so it shifts from poverty. Everybody recognizes it's a seedbed for revolution, but it shifts from the poverty and moves right away into, but we cannot lest the Cuban, Soviet, Marxist-influenced people stir these people up to upset the status quo. That's where we get nervous. So the East-West conflict becomes dominant. The conclusions I draw from this very quickly are that we do have a powerful influence and dominance, that our economic and political interests seem to be most connected with those groups whose self-interest is not for there to be reform. There's kind of an alliance between the interests of the military and the oligarchy and the United States, and all yelling the word communist anytime a reform movement comes along. The poor are not taken seriously. Therefore, democracy is generally a word that is only used in lip service. Same way as freedom and human rights. These are words that are used to gain public support, to give an impression that things are going all right. It does not figure very much into the concerns of U.S. foreign policy. As a matter of fact, historically, we've been just as happy to support dictators. And I guess the thing that's probably the most alarming is that what is created here is a cauldron of problems. It's like a pressure cooker. It's ready to blow. The means to keep the lid on the pressure cooker is military. Which introduces the second concern, low-intensity warfare. It's not new. Any of you remember the Dulles years rollback? The Vietnam years winning the hearts and minds? In the 80s, the concept of low-intensity warfare has become embraced by the Pentagon, so that defense budgets in that area are just skyrocketing. And covert, overt operations in other countries have also increased dramatically. You should know this. It is a philosophy that is now being embraced. What is the philosophy? Basically, it's saying, get three types of warfare. You got high-intensity warfare, that would be a nuclear confrontation, which we hope to avoid. You have mid-intensity warfare, that would be like Iran and Iraq. And then you have low-intensity warfare. It doesn't mean people don't get hurt, but it's limited to things, wars such as you might experience, the Contras, Sandinistas, the leftists, and the government in El Salvador, Afghanistan. Low in intensity in that it is not all out. But here's the philosophy underlying low-intensity warfare. We are in World War III. We just have not realized it. Only it is not being fought in a thermonuclear way. It is being fought on the edges between the Soviet Union and the United States. It's being fought in the Third World for influence. How can we fight this? Well, we learned two lessons from Vietnam. First lesson, why did the American public withdraw support from Vietnam? Two reasons. You remember?
People got killed.
American bodies came back. We saw it on television. So we learned two things if we're going to do low-intensity warfare. We try, if possible, to work through other people's armies, let them do the dying. Secondly, we go through an active psychological campaign to make sure we don't have things on television that are creating the wrong impression. So low-intensity warfare includes four main arenas. First is the military part. Now, this can be pro-insurgency or counter-insurgency. Counter-insurgency would be like in El Salvador, where you invest a great deal of money into the El Salvadorian army so that they can stop the leftist guerrillas. That may include even bombing villages where guerrillas are strong so that the fish don't have water to swim in, as the expression goes. Pro-insurgency would be you equip and enable there to be guerrillas that fight leftist organizations, the Contras, Afghanistan. That's the military part. Economic part. You bring economic pressure to bear to keep people in line as part of this overall warfare. So, as an example, The Contras are not primarily interested in defeating the Sandinista army. They go after economic targets to destabilize the economy, to prove to the Western world that socialism doesn't work after all. Or you make sure that the World Bank does not give a loan to Nicaragua. Those kind of things. Politically, you exert your political pressure in order to get what you want to happen. So when, in 1982, El Salvador picks Dubuisson to be their leader, the U.S., who knows that they can't sell that back to the American public, tells them, pick again. That's the democracy. And the fourth is psychological, and this is what affects us. Tries to create a state of terror where the war is happening. So you have assassinations. The CIA manual that was discovered talking about assassination of people, that's no accident. That's part of this. The terror is part of it. The death squads are part of it. And the people in low-intensity warfare argue, they say, if the American people knew this, they'd be upset, but you have to understand war is war, and you got to go all out to do it, and you got to kill a few people if you're going to create. Also, psychologically, we need to come to the conclusion that democracy is happening in El Salvador, totalitarianism is happening in Nicaragua. So there is a great deal of pressure exerted on the American media. The Contras, $500,000 was spent to a public relations firm in Miami in 1985 in order to have the Contras sold to the American people as a good thing, hence freedom fighters, etc. Highly successful, all part of low-intensity warfare. Now, what is so astounding to me is the implications of this, if you're following. What it is saying is that increasingly our stake lies with the oligarchy and the military. Our means to achieving security is military. We will use disinformation. We will use psychological disinformation. That goes right after the democratic roots of the country. It's a cynical view of human rights and democracy and freedom. I couldn't understand why in El Salvador people would say, whenever we hear about human rights, we know that the terror is right around the corner. I couldn't understand that. Now this makes sense with it. Those become manipulative words that are trying to create a smokescreen for what's really happening underneath. And I think the one that has the most serious implications, and this was drawn in a magazine article, do you realize that what this is doing is launching a war against the poor? And we're funding it. That, to me, theologically, is a powerful implication. Can I say just a bit about liberation theology? And then let's open up for some implications. The image of liberation theology in my parish evokes some red faces amongst some of my parishioners. This is a Marxist, communist plot to infiltrate the churches. According to the Santa Fe document, which is one of the guiding principles in the last decade, that's precisely what it is. So it's got all kinds of images. Yet we know it's been powerful influence in Latin America, so I wanted to find out, what do I think as a parish pastor of liberation theology? Well, here are some of the conclusions I drew. I'm not going to go into detail because I know that this is also being presented. I think it's pretty orthodox in its doctrinal position. Actually, it's more conservative than half the people are walking around here in terms of its view of Christ, of prayer. We had some group from Los Reyes, Mexico, that come out of a base Christian community, and it seemed like all they wanted to do was pray. They had a tremendous spirituality. I've been very impressed, and my exposure to base Christian communities jives with that. There seems to be a deep spirituality and a basic orthodoxy. What's radical about it is that it starts first with the context. And if you're talking about desperately poor people, you're saying, what is the situation in which you live? It uses as one of the analysis tools to evaluate that context Marxism, which says you're poor not just because you don't work hard, even though they still got that in their mind. A friend of mine went down to Guatemala and heard they were doing some talking with some peasants. This guy works 12 hours a day, spends 4 hours after he comes home from work working to try to stretch to feed his family, just barely, asked, why are you poor? And he says, because we're lazy. You know, I mean, that's the kind of the dominant one. But this is, it is not because you haven't worked hard enough and you haven't given capitalism a chance. The reason that you're poor is that the system ruled by the oligarchy and the corporations has it that way and is going to keep it that way. That's why you're poor. That's what's radical. Actually, it's a corrective to a gross misuse of the Christian gospel in the colonial period, in which poor people were generally seen to be fated to be that way because it was the will of God. Another thing I found really interesting, in the United States, we're so worried about liberation theology being violent. From my reading and talking with Walter Altman, it's a whale of a lot less violent than our standard theologies are in justifying our military actions. Basically, what some liberation theologians are saying is, we live in a violent situation, and if all else fails, it may be necessary, though regrettable, to use violence to overthrow the system of oppression. Well, we have bought that one lock, stock, and barrel ever since 1776, and we've used it to justify even having the world in a state of hostage. So I find it, in a way, less violent than I would say our own culture is. I also find it very hopeful. This is one social revolution that's happening where the church is involved. And we know of a lot in world history where the church has been irrelevant. This is one where it's smack dab in the middle. I was moved to be in the presence of some of these poor people in the base Christian communities because I saw a dignity and an intelligence in articulating their theology and their dreams that I don't think could be manipulated. I sensed a spirit there that for the first time in my life I understood why the early church moved. I had never experienced that in the North American continent. I did there. So my impression is that this is something that ought to be looked at seriously. The big contribution of liberation theology to us is it's saying it's not just a matter of giving your heart to Jesus. We have to look at the systems we live with. We have to attempt to Christianize them as well as ourselves. Now, conclusions, and then what time is it here at?
25:05.
Okay. Just a couple conclusions, and then let's take a look at some ways that the local parish. It struck me when I visited that refugee camp in San Salvador from the earthquake that one of the reasons those people so warmly greeted me was that in an indirect way some of the dollars I put in the offering plate went to help them. That made me feel good. What made me feel bad was that one of the reasons they're harassed and some of their people have disappeared, some of the dollars that I've sent off to the IRS have gone to pay for a system that's disappearing them. And what strikes me as one of the more startling conclusions is that it appears to me, on the basis of my reading, that our perceived self-interest needs in this country do not deal with justice issues, and in fact, that we would support injustice. And some of the most significant reform movements, including liberation theology, which is as moderate as you can get, is seen, according to the Santa Fe document, as an enemy. And I suppose the most frightening thing that I would conclude is that if God is indeed on the side of the poor, it is quite possible that we in the U.S. are taking a distinct course of action that is directly in opposition to God. I find that deeply frightening, because we're making war on the poor. And I don't know that we're doing that intentionally, but we certainly are complicit in it. And so I entitled this as Challenge to Our Souls, because the conclusion I arrived at when I came back was, I can't let this one go by, or I will possibly jeopardize the salvation of my own soul, because I'll harden my heart. I fear for our country if we were to adopt a position where we increasingly had to justify the use of terror and repression in order to maintain our economic interests. I fear for our country, not only for what it would do to others, but what it will do to our own spiritual integrity if we don't face it. Now for some discussion starters about the local parish. I see three major things that make this world run real hard. Anybody else here a pastor? Okay. You got three real hard ones to touch if you start getting at this one. Three assumptions. How many of you have grown up believing and perhaps still believe, as I want to believe, that the U.S., although it has to get its hands dirty, is somehow a little bit cleaner in what it's going to do to other people than the average nation in history? You grew up that way. Second, yeah, the fact that you're here means you've already gone through. Second one, that the capitalist system, if allowed to function, is in the long run going to bring out a better system in these poor countries than if you start experimenting with something else. A lot of people believe that. Certainly, a very strong arm of our foreign policy does, and this is articulated very strongly here. And then the third is, we must stop communism. These three myths are the prime movers, it seems to me, in people's mythology, an article of faith as to why we're doing right down there and how come everything's going wrong. I think all of those have to be looked at before we're going to be willing to change. The second thing I think is so critical is, I do not think it's just enough for somebody to work with their lifestyle to give money. I think this has to end up being a political issue. Because as so many people in Central America told me, and I know others of you who travel, I'm sure they've said it, they've said, we're not asking the U.S. to solve our problems. We're just asking them to get out of our way so we can solve our problems. And this would require almost a major conversion, it seems to me, to be willing to see reforms happen, to be willing to lose control, to be willing to lose some of our economic influence. Man, you're touching some pretty cherished idols that will evoke some powerful reactions. But it occurs to me as I think about child labor laws, antitrust, unions, it wasn't the guys in control that eventually said, you know, this is unjust, we really ought to change. It was a constituency that developed, that confronted the problem. They met with strong resistance, but the moral position of their position eventually persuaded, and you began to have some significant change. It seems to me that the church has to provide a constituency in the United States saying, this is immoral. We have got to take seriously the issue of poverty. We have got to take seriously some of these things that are going on. It cannot go on, and we oppose this. And to do that, I suspect, is going to create some hostility and some problems. Now, how some strategies. Here's what we tried in our church. I would really be interested in knowing what some of you think, and let's open up for discussion. We've, of course, done the forums and the Faith and Life series. I was surprised by the response. Probably the one thing that I presented that got people the most angry was low-intensity warfare, because I think it's hard to swallow that we might be that cynical, but I don't know the American people is in general, but I think it's possible if you look at things from a certain perspective, you can be, you know. But it occurs to me that one of the greatest obstacles that exist is a lack of education. I hadn't done any reading about Central America before this trip. I was under a lot of illusions about what was going on there. I'm a history major, probably better educated than in history than the average person, but there were a lot of eye-openers. So one of the things we're doing is with book study groups, because I think there's a process that takes place to be able to change your mind to begin to see things differently. Another thing that we're doing is we've gotten in a support group of other people. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer has said that he thinks you can't do these kinds of things alone and that you need to be in a support group. We meet as we got the children together. We wrote letters for Bread for the World on a hunger bill. And then we meet around a book discussion. I think we're going to use Jack Nelson Pallmeyer's Politics of Compassion. We do this once a month where we get a chance to look at some of these issues, come to a sense that we're dealing with them with integrity. I personally am not, what I didn't want to do when I got back in the parish was become what I term marginalized. There is a person in our congregation who's kind of the resident liberal. And when he gives a forum, seven people show up because everybody's got him out there on the lunatic fringe. They won't listen to him. And I thought, I'm not going to go up, because sometimes when people heard that I went to Central America, several people came up to my wife and said, I'm really kind of nervous, you know, I knew this pastor and I went to Central America, and that's all we heard from the pulpit. And is he going to become radical? Is he going to come back changed? Is he going to be the same? I thought, no, I'm going to speak to the mainstream. I'm going to speak thoughtfully. So I used illustrations from it, but I did not get up and make a big political statement from the pulpit. I think my philosophy is I think it's got to be done in groups of people who are willing to hear it. You begin to do book discussions, try to create constituencies that eventually start representing themselves politically. Why don't I open up? I've talked enough. What are some of the things you found helpful? We've done a few other things in terms of getting at this. It's my assumption that we have to deal with it. If we don't deal with it, who will? How do we deal effectively with it? Given the fact we're expected to be... Go ahead.
I'm afraid I'm going to speak on the other side of it because I'm going to speak some of my frustration. I've tried some of the things you've tried. I'm not a pastor, but a member of a congregation in Salem, Oregon. And my first exposure to this was 4 or 5 years ago up here. I've not been to Central America. But became pretty convicted that we have some real problems with our relationship with our Central American friends. And tried to go back and bring that somehow or another to my congregation. Offered to participate in some kind of an adult Sunday school program, which was always rejected by the people planning the programs. I don't have quite the power you do in that.
I got into the program right away.
Yeah, right. We have a strong tradition of small groups in our church which meet together, pray and study and share. And then decided that I would just announce that I was going to lead a small group with my wife and that the topic of interest would be to study Central American missions. And we went through that year in a small group with one other couple. That's all we could dredge up out of a congregation of several hundred. And just kind of gone on like that. I tried to work through local organizations. We have Salem Commission on Latin America in Salem, Oregon, where I live. It's a dying organization. I just really struggle. The people in my congregation seem very apathetic about the topic and very frightened about the whole thing about communism and liberal, softies who are just, you know, pansies for the hype that's being peddled by the communists down there and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so I just...
You obviously came back brainwashed.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. I'm speaking my frustration. I'd like to hear some better solutions. How do you break through to these people?
I think it's probably worked a little better in our congregation. Maybe it was because another member went with me, and then 3 months later another member went and came back and said things probably a lot more radical. And a part of this interest was what got us just into Habitat for Humanity to come up in Duluth. And we're asking the questions, gee, we don't have any contact with the poor. We need to be doing some things. So I think there, at least at this point, I am seeing more things going on. So maybe it has worked better here. How about some others here? What have you found worked? What have you found hasn't worked?
In our church, we have some of the same problems too, but at one summer we had some forums, and we brought a El Salvadoran refugee just to speak. She just spoke Spanish, and she just told her story, kind of like when you read that story. I mean, that was real. I don't know, you just hear some of the story from the heart, how they were taken away by the death squads, and she escaped being killed. But I think people just kind of think, wow, I just don't believe that could happen. And she wasn't being judgmental of the U.S. I think that's what people are, they don't like you to say the U.S. is trying to be the bad guy, because they feel like they are good, and the U.S. is good. So I think sometimes if people could just tell their story and say, hey, this is what's going on, and don't maybe try to say, make really judgment, just let the people kind of come to those, I mean, it's kind of obvious, you know, I mean, let them come to their judgments, because I think people get really defensive when you try to say your country is being a bad guy, then they shut their ears. You know? So sometimes you can bring a person that's just had a first-hand experience, and just let them say what happened.
Yeah, I think I could say anything from the pulpit, but the two that would elicit the strongest responses is if I raise questions about the capitalistic system, or if I raise questions about the moral integrity of the United States. I think those two, I could talk about anything else, but I think those two would raise the... So I agree with that defensiveness. It's powerful. There was a hand over here. Yeah.
Well, I'm
going to
risk saying something a little bad about her country. I'm not saying it bad, I'm asking you a question. If we support terror and murder in another country, if we support it and help pay for it, what might we do to our own people? What kind of people might we become? If we support it and know what's going on down there, might we then turn and terrorize our own people? I don't want to think that, but it kind of scares me.
Jack Nelson Palmyre, are any of you familiar with him? Some of you are. I would highly recommend, this is in the library, I'd highly recommend this book. He has chosen a more radical response than I have to the data. He is living below the poverty line, so he doesn't pay taxes to this, and pretty much devoting his life. He is of the opinion that the implications of this kind of a posture, if allowed to continue, will eventually turn in on our own populace as well. And that this is not something that we can say, oh, isn't that too bad, you know, but we think it's going to go away or it's going to run its course. Because there are the great implications to the soul to be involved in that kind of thing. So that would be his opinion. I guess I'd share it.
I didn't try to think that. I just noticed that all these people are dying with our money and with our knowledge and complicity. Why did not be then come back on us?
Oh, it is. It's coming back on us right now. I mean, we have a neighbor that went to Central America, lives up the road from us just a mile. He went two or three times working with Technica in Nicaragua. And the FBI came up to his house a couple different times. Well, after they left, he came. My husband's been in Nicaragua. He came right down to our house and said, you know, did they come and visit you too? Gave me a booklet on, you know, you don't have to let them in your house and all the things to do. So it's real, it can be real, I don't know, kind of intimidating, because then you wonder, man, I mean, is his phone being bugged? I mean, the FBI was there twice. He lives clear out in the dingles in the woods. I mean, you have to, I almost get lost going there. I mean, they really had to try and find him. So, and then he wasn't, he works on contracts doing jobs. Well, he had a hard time. Just all of a sudden, all these jobs fell through, and he really felt like they kind of were, you know, on him to tell employers, hey, this guy's been investigated with FBI, and so people were shying away. And then some people coming back from Central America were given a bad time at customs and having everything searched. And just so you kind of knew that if you were interested in Central America, someone had your number, you know, just a little, it is frightening.
One of the more hopeful things I heard, and I think Jack Nelson mentioned this, is that it's generally agreed in policy-making circles that one of the greatest obstacles to pursuing some of the policies that had been envisioned for Nicaragua has been the church. And so I think there's no question that some of these people that take trips down there and some of the constituencies that are developed have really been kind of pain in the rear end to some of these people that would like to pursue this policy. So it would be natural that you would have some kind of reaction. Anything that you found has worked well, yeah, in your congregation?
I don't know if this has worked well, but this spring I gave a series of 3 presentations on El Salvador because I'd gone there last summer, so it was like our Sunday morning class for adults. And we had some really mixed reactions. You know, a lot of questions that I just kind of, that were hard to answer. But the thing that really, that I tried to do, and this kind of, you know, this one gentleman who said that he had inside information on the foreign policy from, I don't know, some government office, that he knew what was going on down there, and, you know, he was kind of really against it. He listened to me, and the second time he came, the second class that I had, he said, you know, I really understand, you know, what point of view you're coming from. He says, it seems like the people are really suffering, and I was trying to, you know, the kinds of things that the people are doing, and he says, you know, I can understand that. And he was, before, he'd just been, you know, almost to the point of being hostile a week before, but this time, because I was trying to really show where the people are, and trying to show, like, the base communities, the Christian-based communities, and their faith, and their intense desire to keep going, and their hopefulness, and just how, what they're doing, and why they're being, and that they're being hurt, and you know, kind of trying to make it more in a question, you know, why are they being hurt? Why are the people that are the teachers and the church people, and the union people, why are those the people that are being pointed, you know, attacked and disappeared? And that seemed to have a lot of people really kind of understood that. I mean, not everybody did. A lot of people still just went away, you know, really saying, well, where do the weapons come from? I have evidence that they all come from the Soviet Union. What's your evidence? You know, I don't know. I haven't seen that evidence. I would like to see it. But I mean, not everybody was satisfied with that still. Yeah. But a lot more people were, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Dan? Oh, sorry. Dan and then...
It's been said in a way that the more that we can help people get in touch with real people and hear stories. At PLU not this school year, the school year before, I'm one of the chaplains at PLU, and it was a very kind of quiet process of taking groups of students, 6, 7, 12, to the house of the Salvadoran refugees
sanctuary
in Tacoma, St. Leo's, and just sit in their living room surrounded by pictures of Oscar Romero. It's like going to Central America, and then just listening to their story, which they're willing to tell over and over and over, and to see students just really converted, and let's say the word conversion, and they really laid the groundwork for the second year of this past school year, being a strong Central America group among the students on the campus. But again, how can we work more with stories? And it'd be an encouragement that, you know, Seattle, Spokane, Tacoma, Portland all have people in sanctuary that have stories. That would be an encouragement.
Yeah, I resonate to that. And I recognize that that's probably one of the most influential things of being in the presence of somebody who tells her story. There was a question.
I was going to say, I hadn't looked on this issue, but I have seen the apartheid in Namibia. Can you introduce that, the politics of that situation in my congregation? Took a lot of time, so I would just encourage you to keep trying, focus on the faith that we share, and don't give up.
That's it, yeah.
Our church is one of those who became sanctuary member, and what we have done, we have kind of adopted a sister church in El Salvador, and we have people going there on a regular basis from the Bay Area, and they actually bring the money on their body to help support them. We help them buy a piece of land so that they could start a settlement. And by the church, we also write letters, sign letters. We're too lazy, so the letter is written, you can read it and sign it. For instance, when Bishop Romero was imprisoned again, that's what we did, so that to make people aware that we do know a little bit of what's going on and we don't agree with it. So that they get the idea that we as people living in the United States, we don't agree what our government is doing there, and we'll let you know.
And there's a good feeling to know that somebody else is in solidarity with you.
Yeah.
Over here, and then.
I'd just like to make an observation. I'm Peter's wife, and what I've observed in our congregation is that having a pastor take a trip like this makes a statement in terms of leadership, and I think it got a lot of attention. On the other hand, people sort of expect pastors to take trips like that, you know, they're missionaries and they're religious people. And they're supposed to do, but Anne, a member of our congregation who went with Peter, I think the combination was really powerful in our congregation because she's, quote, non-clergy, and so that got a lot of attention, and they did the forums together. And Anne and her husband Bob in our congregation are what you would say very influential people with a lot of status in our community. So then Anne's husband went on a similar trip in March, and I've just seen it snowballing in our community. And at Bob's place of work, when he told the people around the table that who were all going on cruises, et cetera, for their spring trip, that he was going to Nicaragua, they just laughed and didn't believe him. They thought, well, we know your wife is nuts, but we didn't think you should. And I see we get a lot of attention in our community because of who Bob and Ann are. And then this support group that we have of four families, and we sort of made a commitment that once a year, one of our group will try to make a trip to the Augsburg Center. And that's really affecting our whole community at large, I think. And I think there's no substitute for, like Dan was saying, you know, being in contact with the people and their stories and going down there, because we are so isolated in Duluth. So, you know, so we have a commitment to try to keep going there and hearing stories and being part of that.
There was a...
In there? Well, it seems to be the question of what you can, churches can do, and it seems the only thing you can do is education. When you can convert 50 million or 100 million people to think the way we do in this group, why then it'll change United States policy, and that's the only way it's going to make any difference down there. Little visits and converting three people in a church group is going to take a millennium to do anything that way.
Well, I think
neocolonialism has been going on for at least a century, and it has, the only way it will be changed is if we vote it out somewhere.
I think there's no question that we're talking about a long-term change of direction, hopefully.
I was curious about the lady here, her parish. You stopped short of being able to preach about it. It sounds like your church is along so that your pastor can preach from the pulpit about such things as on the board up there?
Well, I guess Jim Lang goes sometimes.
So,
we have groups that are very active in this.
So the whole congregation hears it then, on Sunday morning?
We mainly have meetings after church, usually on Sunday, that people can hear and see slides and get more information. It's not usually put into a sermon.
We've had home meetings. We've gone up and down, saying the interest to, you know, it wanes and just comes back in. But we also have a very large Central American community in San Francisco that are very visible and whose poverty is very visible in some cases. But we also, we have people there that are on both sides of the conflict. We have people who are refugees from the oligarchy, and find themselves living side by side with people who are hiding in, because if they go back to El Salvador, they get killed by their relatives. So it's a tenuous kind of thing that when you have it right there. But it's a lot of the path. I haven't gone down yet, mostly because this is about as much discomfort as I can handle. I say that apologetically, but it's unfortunately true. The other thing is that I'm in amenities, Holden Village amenities, not the political situation or the living situation of the people. But it's really hard in communities, in suburban communities where most of the constituency of the Lutheran Church lives, to get very excited about anything other than your own lives. It is frustrating. That's one of the things we're going to talk about in the forum tonight, a little plug, in which I invited Peter and Dan Erlander to talk about, is that what do we do as a church about injustice in places that are far away? We feel so helpless and so distant. And that's what we're struggling with right now. The small things that we do are, I think, significant, because they have a ripple effect when you see people doing it all over. If you listen to the afternoon talk shows, those of you who are privileged to watch Oprah and Phil Donahue or tape them and see them later, you see this kind of ripple effect on social issues that they take up.
Question.
And I have two questions. First of all, you made a comment that went places where the media couldn't go. I don't understand that comment at all. Why couldn't the media go where you went? Couldn't they join your group and go?
That was with regard to Vietnam. I'm trying to remember the comment I made. Places where the media.
What trip you took.
When you talk about low intensity warfare, you talk about the things that were required to.
Oh, yeah. For example, either you modify what the media is able to see or you exclude them. For example, South Africa successfully, simply the media isn't there. One of the reasons Guatemala was able to get away with murdering 100,000 people without us hardly blinking in the early 80s. Was because they didn't let the cameramen outside the city. This was all done in the countryside. And that is incidentally held up as a successful example of low-intensity warfare where you keep the media out, and basically wasn't an issue. So that's the idea. The media question is really kind of complex, because it's not that you keep them out per se, but there are a variety of pressures that are exerted, both economic and political, that tend to create your kind of standard stories that come out of the embassy. Good investigative reporting can be done, but you just generally don't find it in the average newspaper. You almost have to look for it. And if you do look for it, you can find that this stuff has been documented very carefully, but it's not the kind of thing you find in USA Today. And really, that achieves it. Who cares if Sojourners prints it? If USA Today doesn't, you really achieved your goal, because you can create your political base to support the policy.
That was the one question. The other question was, the objection that I've heard several times to people that go to foreign countries like this, and trips like this, is that, well, you're being duped by the people that are showing you around. So, you're just sure. Being shown what they want you to see, and nobody gets the truth after all. How do you answer questions like that?
Well, yeah, I try to anticipate that. For example, especially when I presented half-hour presentations with slides to the Duluth Rotary, which is the 25th Rotary established in the world, so you can imagine how radical they are. And that was a good experience, and I really try to anticipate the fact that you are, you know, that's one of the first questions. There were several things for me. The first was, we talked to a wide range of people that were experts from their perspective. So if I wrote down accurately what they said. Second thing, you attempt to tie in what is said to what you're reading historically. For example, I read a book about Nicaragua purposely by the son of Madeline Murray O'Hara, who's kind of a raving fundamentalist, endorsed by Jerry Falwell, is really saying the Contras are the salvation of Christianity in the North American continent against communism. I read his book on Nicaragua. What I found was that it was so grossly inaccurate, so completely missing some of the major points and reasons and in terms of what he presented, that I could not take it seriously. Well, if I'm hearing things from a variety of people that tend to get repeated, it makes sense when you read historically. When you understand human nature, it makes sense. Then I begin to have some confidence that I'm formulating some opinions that are right. If on the other hand, I'm hearing something that sounds like it's from left field, nobody else is saying it. It's one of these conspiracy theories that you can't get at the reasons why it's being said, then I pretty much discount it. One of the reasons that I chose to do the reading on the sabbatical was I was pretty sure that my perspectives were right because I was pretty impressed with what I heard, but I wanted to make sure that I did do some reading from scholars that could document it, and that it would make sense. And I'm convinced that virtually, I mean, I may be wrong, but at least I'm satisfied that what I read and what I presented can be documented. You can argue a rationale for it. It's consistent with human nature. It's consistent with history. And so I'm pretty convinced that this is essentially accurate. I realize that it's coming at it from a different perspective. If I put on the glasses that say the big threat to our world is communism, and it is creeping up everywhere, and I read all of reality that way, then I'm not going to take any concern for poverty, and I'm going to look at it differently. And essentially, the Santa Fe document, which has informed a lot of our policy, that's what's here. I realize you can look at it from a different perspective, but that's the way I would answer it.